Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we are really thrilled to have Jim from Web DMs with us today to talk about switching between Zero Edition and Fifth Edition, or maybe back, and also how to keep a campaign running. Hi, Jim, how are you today?
I am doing great. I'm so happy to be here. I can't wait to dig into it.
We're super happy we managed to get you to join the show, actually. So, quick acknowledgement to our viewers. Some of us, including us, are having parts of our lives a little bit disrupted these days due to medical concerns. And I think that all of us are planning on doing more D&D streaming in the upcoming future. So, you know, hopefully that'll be a way that we can all stay connected and support each other and recreate together when we need to. So, best wishes for everybody on that. Take care of yourselves, and we hope that we'll be able to keep connected in the near future. So there's that. So, Jim, I heard recently, so obviously you are really famous in fifth edition circles and advice.
That's what I hear, yeah.
Yeah. and I heard that recently you ran a game using zero edition Little Brown Books for the first time.
Yeah, ever. Yeah, these bad boys. Nice. So, yeah, it was great. I'd been prepping for it for a while. In fact, I'd come off of a fifth edition game that was like 100% custom content. Like I was pulling in stuff from Pathfinder and third edition and like, you know, updating it for fifth, all my own stuff, and was just like the weight of it all. It was just like so much. And while it was a blast, I wanted something simpler. So I sat down with the three of them and was like, I've spent, I don't know how many years reading blogs and posts and Fight On and all the others. And like, I'm just going to sit down with the three of them. What do I think? What do I want to do? How do I want to interpret this? And asked my wife, Emma, I was like, hey, you know, would you just run through a dungeon with one character and see how it goes? And she's, you know, bold enough to try, give that a try. And I just built a dungeon according to book three. And and then when I needed a, you know, had a question, I was just like, I can figure it out myself. And it's a palate cleanser. I love it. I absolutely love it.
That's great. That's
I was
great
gonna
to
use
hear.
The exact same words, right? I think yeah. many of us get to that point at some point, and I was going to use the exact same words for, yeah. for we do that. Yeah.
So out yeah, of curiosity, Jim, let's step back. Like when you first like cracked the book and read through it, what was your initial reaction to the raw text?
Oh, so I had read through book one before as a player. I played in an original D&D campaign for about a year and change. 2013, 2014 or so, in Jim Johnson's game. He's put out the Book of Eris. Austin Jim is how most people might know him from, like, I don't know, Dragon's Foot or something. And played in his game for about a year, got an enchanter, leveled my magic user up to seventh level, survived several deaths.
Nice.
Found out the most profitable way to go through a dungeon crawl is by myself. And no henchmen, no fellow PCs, just invisibility and ESP all the way. And you know, taught another player that it's perfectly fine to lie to the DM, that's okay, and just that they don't need to know I cast a sleep spell on them. It's a death spell to those goblins, you know, and that I love the purity of it. And yeah. I got to play in this game, and my character, Mithras, I've got like all of his character sheets. It's like one of my favorite characters. And I constantly talk about it. And so, like, I've been a lifelong DM, and I was like, okay, I've played the game. I have all this DMing experience. I'm just going to, like, sit down with the books and read them. And, of course, like, the first thing I thought was, like, gosh, this needs an editor bad,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
and started making my own editorial marks because I used to do that for college admissions. And as I was doing that, realized that I'd started to make my own rules summaries. and then my own rules clarifications. Yep. And then I was like, well, this seems weird, or this is a gap in the rules. Like, what do I want to do? Yep. And found that because I, you know, had been soaking myself in the best of the old school blog scene for as long as it's been around, you know, at least 2009 is the first time I can remember finding, say, Grognardia.
Yep.
And using that advice to make my new school games better, I found that I was just like, okay, well, I've already ported over reaction rolls, morale, how to stock a dungeon, how to build a dungeon, all of that into third edition, fourth, and then fifth. It was just, it was effortless. And because there's so much less to have to scrape away, I'm able to build up what I absolutely want. And it's been really fun.
You know, it's really interesting. I feel like I saw this play out recently on Twitter where somebody was sort of, somebody pitched, like, somebody explained to me the OSR. And I saw a great response that was like, well, the whole, like, violence, roll, dice, really is not an original D&Dism. It's more of a third edition era kind of style of play. And that there's this kind of prejudice, I think, that old school must mean all combat and no role play, which I think is actually the opposite of the truth.
Yeah. It was what drew me to old school in the first place. I started D&D at the tail end of second edition. And while I had like the 25th edition Silver Anniversary box set, so I had like the Holmes reproduction that came with that, I think. Mm-hmm. And I'd flip through that and be like, this is weird, and ran through Keep on the Borderlands and the Against the Giant series that came in with that as my first time I ever DM'd Dungeons & Dragons. I played Warhammer before that. And just was like, okay, this is all part of just D&D. You know, I didn't see that much difference between that and, say, late second edition. And we made characters with the full character options, the black bound books with the splitting a stat into two and all that stuff. And I found that third edition was simpler. I got it. I was the first one in our group to pick it up as a DM, but that it was that combat. And I was constantly saying, like, gosh, I would love if somebody talked to an NPC.
Yep.
I would love if somebody didn't just like look at everything and see it as a pile of loot and XP. And when I read, say, Philotomy's Musings or would go on Grognardia, I'd be like, oh, my God. So one of the first things I did was stop giving out XP for monster slaying. And that changed a lot of my third edition games entirely. And then from there, I just started incorporating the best of wherever I found it. And it was a seamless fit because to me, it's all D&D. Fourth edition is kind of the outlier in that. but the rest of them, I feel very comfortable taking one thing from one and putting it in another and just running with like it's D&D to me.
Yeah.
We just had, so last week we had Zach Howard, who runs the Xenopus Archives website, who I think is the currently the world's expert in that Holmes basic set. And it's funny because, you know, that original D&D product really did need editorial oversight. And I think that Holmes was the first one to show what that would look like. And then other days I wrestle with the fact that the fact that we need to interpret the little brown books and fill in the gaps, maybe that's what hooks us in, is like you need to, you know, customize it and make it your own. So from day to day, I'm like, gee, I wish it was perfect to begin with, but then maybe it wouldn't be so intoxicating, you know.
Yeah, because you find yourself defending them, even though they're kind of indefensible in some ways as like as products.
But
the ideas in them are so potent that to me it outweighs, it's worth the effort to put into it, to fill in the gaps, to make it your own. And the fact that it's like meant to be, as opposed to say making AD&D your own, is much worse. Third edition or fourth or even fifth is while they make it easier, it still takes a lot more work than building up what you want.
You know, I feel like I regularly point out to folks, one of the things that really threw me as a kid was recognizing that the basic line and the advanced line were actually two separate lines of a different products. And the thing that always strikes me as the main difference between them is that advanced is trying to be comprehensive, where basic feels more like a toolkit. And that's what really draws me to the basic line of stuff, is that having that, you know, that toolkit that I'm expected to tinker with.
Yeah, I think to me, tinkering was always a part of DMing. Mm. Like I cut my teeth on GURPS, actually. My first RPG was Warhammer, and then I quickly was like, wait a minute, there's a system out there I can use for anything, and it's got all the rules. And so like the math didn't bother me because I was already putting together vehicles and GURPS vehicles and right. and other things as a teenager. And so the idea that you put together the game you want was very much ingrained in me from an early age before I ever ran into D&D. And then when I did, I got a lot of actually bad advice, a lot of pick the ending you want and work them towards that ending. And thinking like, well, that sounds not as much fun as the way I want to do things.
We agree. Right. Wandering DMs officially agree that doesn't sound quite kosher.
It just doesn't sound very fun, yeah. And I played in that game. And so when I switched from player to DM for this group and was getting the advice from a DM, I was like, wait a minute, we asked you not to DM anymore. great player, not so great DM. I found that was already my attitude. And then I had changed it. And when I found the blog scene, I was like, oh, I recognize this kind of freewheeling, let the players take the lead style. Then it was a matter of getting my play group to be amenable to that, because it took some time for them to be like, oh, wait, we don't have to either check every 10-foot square exhaustively to get through this, or like if I talk to something in the world, if I interact with it, I'm going to get something back, because for years that hadn't been the case for them. So it was fun to get them to open up as well, you know.
That's great. When people, you know, switch tables, right, switch between DMs, there is like a cultural shift. And, you know, like, so I had a couple of people playing role, you know, that I was DMing on Friday night playing role-playing games for the very first time. And right out of the box, I said, now be aware, this is how I run this particular edition. If you go with some other DM, they might say different things about some of this stuff. There sometimes if people don't realize that there's that customization happening, they might be surprised by that, and it's really good to kind of be aware of that up front.
Oh yeah, yeah. And that's we try to hammer that home a lot with on WebDM. Is just like, listen, the foundation of this game is you and other people sitting down to engage in this experience. Like, that should be the foundation for everything. Talk to everybody first, you know. Yeah. And I think what you're mentioning, Dan, is really important to say, like, this is, as a DM, this is where I'm coming from. You know, this is the house rules that I'm going to implement. This is the place I will make rulings from. Here's what you can assume about me. That kind of thing. Just like, right. Really smooth things over.
You know, I feel like 5th edition is perhaps the edition to the recent edition that is trying to sort of pull back some of those ideas, right? If I look at the more recent editions, when they merged advanced and basic in 3rd, and even in 4th, it was still more like advanced than basic and trying to be comprehensive. Whereas feel like 5th is really the first time we're trying to see more embracing of customization, or I suppose as the kids call it now, homebrewing, right?
Homebrew, yes. Yeah, yeah. I'm glad it's back and with a vengeance. My take on 3rd was that it was supposed to be exhaustive. And at the time, I thought that was great.
Yeah, you know,
it was like, wow, I have, because it was the only thing I ran, I internalized a lot of the rules and, you know, it was just what I was used to. But when it was like, I got to spend 3 hours making a stat block for someone that's going to last 4 rounds, you know, I'm not having a good time on my end. And to me, the DM's lonely fun, which I think is a BS term, is as important as the play, because it's the DM who's going to like get a group together. You know, the players might be excited, they might recruit for the DM, but a lot of times the DM is sort of the nucleus and the grain of sand around which a group will form. And I think like it should be as fun away from the table for the dungeon master in whatever way they want, whether it's getting into character, coming up with voices and like really bringing their NPCs to life, or intricately plotting out how their world works before the PCs come in and mess things up, you know. I think that is as important as a gameplay experience as what happens at the table, and is oftentimes not really considered as such
That's great. I love that observation. Yeah. As someone who tends to be, I don't know, a bit self-sacrificing, that's a really good germ of an idea to carry with us, actually.
Yeah. It's like, how are you going to get excited about something that you then present to people you want to engage with if you're not in love with it somewhere else? But, I mean, that also comes with the advice of, like, don't take it too seriously and, like, bring it par-baked. You know, it's not finished yet. But bring something you're excited about, certainly.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, we talk...
Sorry, go ahead, Dan. Paul. Oh, now we're both trying to be polite. Okay. You know, it kind of reminds me of something I've said many times whenever, like, edition wars come up, right? And especially, I see that on my blog a lot, because sometimes I talk about fifth and sometimes I talk about original, and I like them both, and I like to steal things from one and put them in the other, and not everybody is into that, but... you know, my defense of that is always, you know, the system that's the best is the system that the DM is excited to run, right? That is way better than, like, strong-arming your DM into playing something that everyone else loves, and then they just don't bring that energy to the table.
Yeah, yeah, I think system matters to a point, but it's not the only thing that matters. And, yeah, you're right. And what I like about 5th and what I like about, you know, Zero Edition, original, is, like, they are easy to manipulate, to kind of, you can get a fifth edition experience that you want if you're willing to put in the work, if you're willing to tweak things and make it fit, and get a group that's on board with you. You can do a lot of things with it, but so it is a different game, you know.
Paul and I very briefly chatted with Matt Finch a couple weeks back at TotalCon in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Matt Finch wrote the Old School Primer about 10 years ago that it's a really, we think, is a good induction point for, you know, old school type gaming. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he pointed out is that when he wrote it 10 years ago, it was largely a response to third edition. And I know when I saw third edition, it was like comprehensive and I thought this looks great. And then the frustrations kind of built up over time. And Finch said that, you know, a lot of those things that he was fighting against in the old school primer aren't so much an issue anymore with fifth edition.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that actually has started to come kind of full circle. And there's less of a gap between zero edition, fifth edition than third, as a matter of fact.
Oh, yeah. Like, I find players a lot more amenable to the back and forth interaction of, say, the use of a skill. Now, they definitely come at it from a new school perspective of, I am using a skill option on my character sheet menu kind of mindset. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But if you ask them to describe it, if you present the situation as not think of it as a skill thing, but think of it as like, all right, there's a wall in front of you. You suspect there's something there, a hidden compartment. Tell me what you do. Mm-hmm. And then I'll ask for a role. Like, I find that they're very amenable because that's emotive. It's what they're there for are those moments where they can add little details to make their character come to life. And I think, like, what I found in the player base is that it's much more character focused and like, getting to have those moments in the midst of a fantastic adventure is what people are after, not necessarily the challenge. In that way, it's different, but in other ways, it's very similar play style.
Great.
Yeah.
So, Jim, I'm curious to hear then, like, what it sounds like we're starting to toe in on this a little bit of, like, what are you bringing from old school gaming into your fifth edition games, or what from fifth edition are you bringing back into original edition when you run it?
So I, like I mentioned before, I bring in morale and reactions, and all the entire encounter and dungeon exploration apparatus whole cloth. I make very little changes to it. And really the only thing you need to do is like assign morale values to monsters. And I prefer to use like a template approach. That's my cat. She'll be only get louder. I'll have a, you know, whatever it is, 2 through 12 or whatever, like, okay. 2 is kobolds and 1-1 type, you know, mm-hmm. creatures, or CR, you know, less than CR 1 for the 5th edition folks. And then just go from there. And as well as the reaction. I love reaction tables. I've got Courtney Campbell's on the NPC, and that really changed my life in some ways. It's like, oh my God, it's really fun. Because it takes so much pressure off me. Mm-hmm. I find I'm such a softy as a DM. I am such a, I don't want you guys to have a bad time. I invited you over to my house. I made you food. Yeah. We're here to have, you know, you've had a shitty week. You know, you're my best friends.
Yeah.
And so in order for me to be the bastard DM that the dungeon requires, that the game requires, I like to have the fence of, well, you know, the reaction told me these guys are trying to betray you.
Interesting.
And like, just that little bit is enough for me to completely change my mind.
Are you making those rolls behind the screen or in front?
In front. And sometimes I let the player roll one of the reaction dice.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. That's good stuff.
Because I think, like, you can't just give them the 5th edition charisma bonus on a 2d6 table. It's going to just throw everything off. Yep. But they want some kind of participation.
Yep.
And so maybe I bump it up to a d8 instead of a d6 or something like that. But I find it works. When I'm playing at the table, it works really well.
I feel like we are both...
Sorry, go on, Dan. I keep cutting you off.
We have so many questions. Paul and I are both, very dedicated. You know, not having done this forever, but having discovered when you make the rolls in public, and you set the stakes and you tell the players, like, here's exactly what I'm rolling for and here's what I'm looking for. It increases the tension, the drama so much, and increases the stakes that this is actually for real when these dice come up, and everybody kind of at my tables kind of crouch around. Yeah. For something like a wandering monster roll, and they really are really invested in whether that comes up a one or not.
Absolutely.
I've seen Dan do this too. Like when we talk about setting the stakes, I think you don't always have to be super specific about it. But if you're rolling on a reaction table, maybe even a custom reaction table that you've got written out behind the screen, you just hand the players the dice and say, here's a D8. You want to see this come up high, and I want to see it come up low. That's enough guidance for them to go, and then lean in and roll the dice and get excited about the response.
Yeah. And there's some kind of, I don't know, I often describe it on our YouTube channel. Just a second. I'm going to pick her up. That's the lady here.
Yeah, bring her in. Special guest, unannounced.
Special guest, Abby. there's an alchemy of play that happens in that moment of between the DM deciding what they're going to call for, what kind of die roll they're going to call for, and the player describing what they do, where for me, that's a moment where there's a lot more negotiation that can take place. There's a lot more back and forth. It doesn't have to rely on a die roll. It can just be, okay, well, all right, let's talk it out before we roll the dice. Yeah. Or let's roll the dice and then interpret it. There's a lot of different ways to do it. And I think like sticking to one or the other, to me, hems me in. Please don't mute it. Please don't disconnect the call, Abby. I like it, and I like switching it up, and I like doing something that's appropriate for the moment.
And the other thing you said that I don't hear a lot, but I totally agree with, is that I have built a number of mechanics for myself because I don't trust myself to be objective in the actual play sessions. Secretly, I'm actually a big fan of the players and their characters, and I actually don't want perish myself.
Oh, so, my God. Yeah.
Right. So I actually commit to having those die rolls in public so that I can't, so that I cannot fudge it to make it real. And as a little bit anecdote, and actually Zach was asking me to talk a little bit about it. So on Friday, I was running the dungeon out of that Blue Holmes book, actually, for group of six, two people they played with me before, two played some fifth edition, two never played any role playing at all. And they get to, and the session goes on, and they get lost in the tunnels at one point. And at the end of the session, they burst into the room that has the horrible mega spider that Gygax put in there, right? And I that moment, I'm like, well, this is really bad. And I'm starting to feel bad that these people's first experience might be a series of fatalities. Mm-hmm. Well, the spider bites the first one of them. You know, I ask for the first save or die, and they fail it. And, you know, everybody's really excited. Like, there's a lot of drama going about this. And someone's trying to escape and open the door, and they're failing their strength checks to open it, so they're locked in with it. And the poison's knocking down one, you know, one at a time. And they're all, you know, screaming with delight and excitement and horror. And half of them got out and half of them didn't. It actually was totally the spectacular climax of the game that I was really worried about going into it. But it turned out to be the most exciting part. And I couldn't predict that, so I...
Oh, God, it's the number one reason why I roll without a screen.
Yep.
Because the temptation to go like, ooh, I don't know, or are they going to be okay with this, is like completely eliminated, and I have not regretted it since. Yep. In fact, it touches on a recent video we did about fudging die rolls, and to me, there's really only two ways in which I would. Check out the video if you want to see it. I don't want to repeat myself, but like... that moment of delivering those experiences, that came when I realized that for me as a DM, I need firm boundaries on what I should be doing, that to think of myself as controlling everything else in the game world the way many rule books do was overwhelming me. And so like setting up mechanics for myself and mechanical rubrics for myself, it was a really great way of giving myself that. And then I found that the beauty of emergent play. And that was one of those things where it's like, I bring D&D techniques that I use to DM with me to almost any game because I want that emergent experience. And it's really fun when it's a game like, say, Warhammer, and the stakes are, well, your arm is one of the stakes, or whether or not you turn into a chaos abomination are one of the stakes. And I don't know what's going to happen either. you know, it makes for a really wild ride.
I think that's great advice.
Yeah. I feel like Maliszewski called it the oracular power of dice, right? And the funny thing is I've also used that on the other side of the scale a lot, where a player asks me something that I think is inconsequential. You know, what time of day is it? Is it raining out? What's the weather like? You know, anything where I'm like, well, I haven't thought of that because I didn't think it mattered. I'm not going to spend a lot of brain power trying to deduce, what would the weather pattern be like at this time of year? And just roll some dice and get the information out there. And sometimes it is inconsequential. Sometimes turns out vastly important down the road, and I had no idea.
Right. Yeah. And putting some of that in the player's hands is always really fun. One of my other favorite games is Numenera. And one of the things I like about it is that the DM rolls no dice. And what I found that let me be much freer in combats. My combats became much more freewheeling, much more epic and sort of cinematic. And I think the system really supported it. But it's kind of one of those where sometimes I like playing D&D where it's like, I'll roll the dice when I'm ready. If there's a reason I can give the players to roll the die for something, I usually let them have it. If only because it's like, I didn't roll that. That's you who did that to yourself. If something terrible comes up.
I had a critical hits table up until recently, and I thought it was too complicated. But specifically for critical hits on the players, I would make them roll it. It's one thing I would make them, and it was a percentile base, and it could be instant death. I was like, you roll those percentile dice. And it really, you know, it really just felt like hot and cursed and horrible as they picked it up to roll it. And it was really high stakes.
Yeah, and I think that like that's the difference between the baseline 5th edition experience and other games, where the baseline 5th edition experience is that at the end of this session, you're going to have the same character, except maybe more powerful. And I am in the game, I play games to have to erase things off my character sheet, to have to adapt to changes I didn't expect. I play it almost outwit the DM if I can, in a lot of ways. And so like from a player perspective and being a part of a wired player base, I find in that sense, 5th edition doesn't deliver the kind of game that I want, but these others do. And I was worried to switch things up and confuse it further from a DM's perspective, are players of 5th edition and other games where their character is not necessarily in jeopardy beyond second level, are they willing to play a game like In this case, I'm thinking about Warhammer 2nd, but original D&D or something where the lethality rate is much higher and maybe don't get attached to those early characters as much. And I found that, they love that. Like, that it's a way to push a button that it doesn't get pushed with mainstream D&D.
Yeah, that's great. When I introduced the new players on Friday, I held up the little brown books and I said, so we're running original D&D, and I will tell you that original D&D doesn't care about your feelings very much. So don't get too attached to these characters. No. I care, but the rules don't.
Right. I'm actually surprised at how much advice is in there that's like encourages you to actively deceive not just the characters, but the players. Yeah. And sometimes I can see that. Like I'm always the mapper. If I'm playing old school, I love making maps as a DM. I don't mind interpreting the Dungeon Master's descriptions and like that my map's not going to look like theirs. And so I was reading the section where they're like, oh, yeah, this is a room labyrinth, or these are shifting passages that are meant to confuse. And at first, my notes is like, WTF, Gygax, like, what's going on here? But then taking that principle of these things are here for a reason. Like, if something sticks out as me as, like, odd, I'm just going to roll with it and realize, like, well, if that's working on a meta level. You're playing the game at the game level and the meta game level at that point. And you're playing not just your character, but against the DM. And there's not a lot of games that are actively adversarial like that in a fun and engaging way. It's a lot of dicks out there who play adversarially.
Well, you know, you're right.
So, but real quick, there's been a little bit of chatter going on in our chat stream here about rolling dice in the public and fudging, whether it's good or bad. Jim, sounds like you have a video about that up on WebDMs, and maybe we can quickly plug where folks can find that.
So if you check it out, I don't have a link handy at the moment, but it's this week's video on our YouTube channel, so right. You should so see it and.
YouTube.com/wandering. That's ours.
YouTube.com/webdm. I think so. If we have, this is how much I know about the back end of this thing I'm a part of. It's a good thing I have some partners.
Great.
I believe that would get us there.
Speaking of tricking the players.
Right.
Yeah, great. The other thing I'd love to draw out of you a little bit here is just for the specifics on your how you're using morale in 5th edition. Like, what kind of roll is that? Are you using any stats from the monsters? When do you make the roll? Can you give us any specifics?
I kind of have three sort of rough guidelines for it. So, I'll have my universal morale table. Mm-hmm. And if it's, one of the myriad of D&D monsters, that I'll pick from, I'll just assign it usually based on their CR or something. Aberrations and undead have high morale because they're aberrations and undead.
Yep.
Constructs similarly. Whereas like fey creatures might have a low morale just because they don't. Just not in it. Their heart's not in it, mm-hmm. And a lot of times it's contextual. I don't have like I haven't gone through and assigned all the monsters a morale score. And then it's like, okay, based on the reaction roll, I will determine when I make the first morale check. So if the reaction roll was like neutral and the players brought the fight, then it might be first casualty. Okay. But if it's, if I rolled hostile and the players were ambushed, then it might be, 25% casualties, 50 leader dies, something like that. And a lot of this is fueled by the fact that I have a master's in military history. And so I've read a lot of like firsthand accounts of people in the late Renaissance and through early modern, what their experiences of battle were like. And so it informs a lot of how I play the enemies. And what I found was that when I started having enemies surrender, run away, drop their weapons, get scared, like do something other than video game auto attack, the players responded. They were like, this is new. What do we do with prisoners?
That's great.
And like, then you start having philosophical and, questions of morality in your D&D, and it's not a BS alignment argument.
Yep.
And everybody's like, did we play D&D? I was like, you're damn right we did.
That's great. And are you using the 2 to 12 rating with a 2d6 roll for that?
Yep. Yeah. I find more and more as I game, especially if it's D&D, I keep basically 2d6 and 2d20 nearby, and even for 5th edition. And a lot of times I know that dice are a sacred part of the culture, and I'm glad for it. I have a ton of them. But when I'm behind the DM screen, figuratively, I find that they're very distracting. And so I want as few as possible, and I want very clear ways of which I will roll them. And really the only thing, just to kind of briefly touch on it, that I roll in secret is like number appearing type stats, things that are purely for my benefit. But otherwise, it's all out in the open, including like morale, reaction, things like that.
Yep, that's great. And I agree also that like I have the fewest amount of dice at the table when I'm DMing usually, and it's pretty close to. I mean, we saw Bill Webb running a game with 30 players, and all he had is just one d20 and one d6. It can be very elegant like that. I feel like you have to see the little brown book rules to realize how minimal and how stripped down it can be like that.
Yeah. It was almost to the point where I was reading them, I was like, surely someone out there has like squared the circle between chainmail and OD&D and like merged the two. Yep. And of course, the minute I went looking, I found multiple ways that people have done that. And that's when I was kind of like, maybe for me, I want to play that. I don't necessarily want to run it. I would love to play that game. But when I think of running it, I think of it's a little too different from what I want. But yeah, it was similarly with Matt Finch. I played in his Jordoba campaign a couple of game hole cons ago and was just really impressed with the fact that he stood up, no, like barely any notes, barely any die rolling on his part. And most of the casualties was just because we were being silly and stupid, you know, or impatient a lot of times. And that for the most part, it's mostly reactive. Like once the stage is set, and that's a great appeal to me as well. So
we've got a follow-up question here from Ash, who's asking about like when the monsters, when you get to that morale check and the monsters run away, how often do you find that your players are trying to chase them down versus some other kind of reaction?
Ooh, well, if I'm not giving XP for monsters, rarely will they chase them down, unless it's like a personal vendetta thing, unless it's like I am out for this monster, you know. And these days, my monsters, when they run away, might Misty Step. They might Plane Shift. They might do any number of things other than just move. They might burrow. I love burrowing. Mostly because in fifth edition, I rule that you can't opportunity attack if someone burrows away, you know, things like that. Yeah. And so I try to take that kind of attitude towards the game, back with me as well when I play old school, but that's usually how I do it. I don't find that players go after them unless it's a personal thing, in which case I've done my job, right? They care enough about this villain to seek blood.
I have a recurring villain now on 10 Dead Rats who's a vampire who's twice escaped now by turning into a bat and flying away. And I kind of suspect that my players are letting him do it because they just enjoy the character so much they want him to come back.
Oh, I wish I would have that happen. That's awesome. I love that. My players, as soon as one of them escapes, they swear blood vengeance. Yeah, they're like, okay.
I see that a lot too. Yeah. Minor rule point. I'll say Paul and I are both very, you know, anti the standard, like someone runs away and you get a free attack on them. We actually are very negative on that rule. And I actually don't recognize that rule at all anymore. And I think, Paul, you're in the same boat, right?
Yeah. I mean, I use the when I'm running fifth, I definitely use the attack of opportunity rule.
Okay.
I think it is actually much scaled down from where it was in third. I think that the chances of it happening are way less. And the introduction of reactions has meant that any given person can really only do it once, right? So you're not just flooding the combat with these attacks of opportunity like you were in third.
Oh, yeah. Third, you get insane amount of attacks from optimizing your opportunity attacks. Yeah. But I like it in fifth. Just because it is kind of tactical. But in games where a hit can kill you and a round is more than a 6 second moment, I don't like having a free attack. I think the likelihood of getting in over your head is already significant. Like, I'd like to leave a door.
I agree very strongly.
Yeah, that's the one thing that both Dan and I have house ruled into our old school games is adding some buffer between zero hit points and death.
Yes.
I find, personally, I use a system where I give them some critical injury, like a broken limb or some, you know, bruised ribs or something that sounds really unpleasant. Mm-hmm. Just so that they can have that moment of, oh, I'm in over my head, maybe I better get out of here.
Yeah, that's what I love about Warhammer, at least in the second edition I played, is that it's possible to get to zero, and if you don't roll that bad on the crit charts, you can still, you know, my broken arm, I'm bleeding, my guts are hanging out, but I'm going to go down swinging moment.
Yep.
Yes, I hear you. You're going to be the same way, Kitty, I know.
Yep.
So I love those moments, and I want to give them to players. So I find I take a lot of the drop to zero, come back with one kind of things, like Berserker Rage or, you know, Death Ward or something like that. I love those.
Yeah. Really, that's my critical chart is definitely very heavily inspired by that Warhammer critical wounds chart. And it really shaped my first old school campaign because I had a lot of players who were missing limbs.
Right. And then otherwise, it doesn't happen that much.
No, it doesn't.
You don't get that sense of a character being scarred by their experience as much.
Yep.
But yeah, that's really awesome. I'd love to see those at some point. Is it just like you get to zero hit points and then you start rolling on the table?
Yeah, basically. Anytime you're at zero hit points and you take damage, you roll on the chart and it's a two roles, one for severity and one for location, and then I, as DM, have to interpret what that means. Mm-hmm. So you might have a broken ankle or a severed hand, or very amusingly once had to adjudicate what a severed face is. That was brilliant. I really enjoyed that one.
That's great.
He was the player was actually off on their own in the dungeon fighting evil pixies, and then got killed as a result afterwards. Stuck around to fight it out and got killed. Mm. And so later the rest of the party discovered it, and I had the pixies wearing his face.
Yes, as you would. You know,
why wouldn't they wear his face? One of the spookiest moments I had in that campaign. There was a lot of horror elements in that particular section. And the best part was the guy, the player who died, he was at the table, but playing a new character because his character's dead, and the rest of the party has no idea what happened other than he's got a new character. Something terrible must have happened.
Right.
That weird meta element actually really ramped up the eeriness of the whole thing.
That's great.
Dude, pixies are supposed to be like, you know, elvish and fun and tricksters.
Yeah, but they were evil pixies. They were specifically evil pixies.
I'm convinced.
I was running Stonehell. That's what the notes told me. Evil pixies.
Yes.
That's great. So I'm going to ask, when you ran Emma in your custom dungeon using the little brown books, how many characters did she have and how quickly did they die?
She had the one and no deaths. So I'm using Scarlet Heroes solo adventure rules for this, which are an overlay for D&D.
Okay.
And they're a bit more, they provide for a bit of a cushion in the sense that you don't die at zero, you roll on a calamities table.
Okay.
So it might be that you lose everything and got dumped in a river underground. Like, it's not good. You know, it usually adds a wrinkle or a complication to you got knocked out sort of thing. And then damage is done directly to hit die. So monsters don't really have hit point pools. They have as many hits as their hit die. And then what the player's rolling for is how many hits they do. Is it one, zero, one, or two? Okay. With twos only really reliably being able to be reached by fighters, high strength characters, that kind of thing. And so it's like real, like they fit in the back cover of book one. Yep. For me. And so that's how I do it. We've only had a chance to run her through it once, and then I ran a larger group through it, which only had henchmen deaths. They put a bunch of them in the back with no light source, and that's just a mistake, you know. Like, they're just begging for those henchmen to get picked off, and I had they did. But none of the players, most of the players were in the 2-3 level range. They were pretty hardy, and so they survived just fine.
I like that idea of a calamities table for that, actually, to like end the action, because kind of as we said before, it's actually not something that I would think about on the fly and not something I would trust myself to be like I would always be gentle with that if I thought that was an option.
Yeah.
And you know, there were a number of solo play suggestions in Strategic Review and the original Dungeon Master's Guide. But anytime I would run a single, you know, character through it, you know, basically the first wizard with a charm spell or the first spider with poison, you're finished at that point.
Yeah.
So that's actually a really nice addition to make that more playable.
Yeah. So in this case, this game would recommend that the player play out that time spent charmed. And have to deal with that and seek ways to end the condition themselves, right? Like being attacked too much or being, you know, arrange for antagonism between the caster and the charmed if they can. It's a lot of advice for how to adjudicate those type of situations and make them adventurable moments instead of campaign enders, nice. Which I really liked. But you also have to have a player who's willing to, like, lose all their stuff and be captured or be put under a spell. It does require a different player mindset, I think, than what a lot of players I played with would do. A lot of trust.
That would open up a lot of options, actually. That's nice.
Yeah. I did forget there's a sort of a third component to that, which is every character has what's called a fray die, which is automatic damage dealt for being in combat with this character. So for a wizard, it represents like magic missile or even a lesser type of, you know, combat spell. For fighters, it just represents elbows, kicks, you know, the fact that you're swinging a giant sword around. So it's extra damage on top of what you would normally do. It's automatic. And so it increases the survivability. The times that I played I had a first level fighter who took on like I think six skeletons at once, and because of that fray die, I survived with barely a scratch, not even half hit points.
You know, that's interesting because, you know, the standard rule to begin with was, you know, whatever the fighter's level is, that's the number of attacks they get. Mm-hmm. And that, on the one hand, that becomes burdensome. And I also don't like the fact that there's this radical switch between a one hit die creature and a one plus one hit die creature where you're taking right. out 12 of the one and just one of the other. So that's actually yeah. kind of a really nice alteration to that rule that usually bothers yeah. me.
And it scales with your hit die, so you always get that fray dice against equal or lesser hit die creatures. So as you go up, it scales. Yeah. Okay. But then it's okay. like we ran into a four hit die white or something, and it mopped the floor with us because we didn't get our extra damage. And so it was did fine against the skeletons, and then really struggled against that fight. But it also was an epic moment because we got this moment as first level D&D characters yeah. of taking on six skeletons and a white, no cleric, you know, yeah. a fighter and two magic users basically. And we was supposed to be a solo game, but then more people joined in as we kept going, and right. it was like, oh, you find more people in the dungeon. But it you know, we had this heroic moment taking out the skeletons, and then like the Lich King gets up and it's like, oh wait, four hit die. But as we whittle away the hit die with successful attacks, eventually it gets to one, and now it takes the fray damage. So it kind of escalates things in a fight against a larger creature as well, because you're doing direct hit die damage. You have a chance against larger creatures, and it's but you still have to play smart. You still have to have that edginess and craftiness that old school play demands.
Nice.
So, yeah. Jim, if I can ask,
sure.
the white box D&D games that you're running here, is this just for fun, or is this some research for some future something we might see out of WebDM?
I hope it becomes fruitful. A lot of it is adapting it to my homebrew world, and mm-hmm. so I have two at the moment, which have a shared cosmology and the like. At the moment, I'm adapting D&D to the more you'd call it standard fantasy of those. I'm avoiding the post-apocalyptic Mad Max meets D&D style campaign world that I have as my other one. I would like to. I think it's fun. I took as just a project for myself. Mm-hmm. I took the Dyson Logos maps for my private Jakala, sort of that massive web of sewers and cellars yep. and everything. And just copied them into a notebook, made some changes to fit them, and then populated them as just like a let's see if the D&D rule books will produce something that I think is like uniquely mine. And it ended up with me having to make my own custom wandering monster charts and stocking tables. And a lot of that was, I found, really fun exercise in world building and figuring out how this will all fit together at the table. Because like for me, the minimalist stat line is just not enough. I need a little bit more. I need at least two lines instead of one. I need a two-page dungeon instead of a one-page
yeah,
kind of thing.
Yeah,
I agree with that. Yeah. I have said the same thing to Paul about that issue when he wants me to run one-page dungeons.
Yeah, yeah. I love them in theory, but I always flesh them out a little bit more before I go in. I think, you know, that's the point. But when I'm doing them, you know, doing it myself, I find that, you know, sometimes I'm writing a paragraph and sometimes it's just a couple of lines and, you know, whatever the situation needs, but at least two.
Yep. I agree with that. I agree with that actually. Yeah. And I don't want to be totally handcuffed to if something does run a little bit long, I don't want to be totally handcuffed to a particular limit like that.
Certainly. And I, more and more, I find myself that what I create in those lines are custom tables. You know, that I will then roll on and play to see which yep. one of these three options I can't decide on right now will get used. And that still retains that moment of excitement and uncertainty for me.
I mean, that's the key, I think, for any kind of short format writing that I really enjoy is finding that right level of information to put in there that is enabling me to make choices at the table without completely painting myself into a very specific corner.
Oh yeah, definitely. The challenge I'm finding is as this goes on the longer, especially like this being WebDM and sort of like being a D&D content creator, I guess you call it, is that writing for myself as a DM versus writing for a public audience, that's been the biggest hurdle for me, if only because I have these very high standards for what I want and feel like should be presented. And so I feel like bridging that gap has been something that, like, it's been a fun challenge, but it's also been like I've had to create new habits for myself and create new, a lot of, like, say, populating an entire 23-page or 23-map dungeon was to get me thinking and writing and creating D&D content in a different way than I had up until then. And so, so far it's been successful.
I've had to really, like, force myself to remember not to beat myself up for when making content for publication versus myself about how lengthy it gets. Because I think when you're writing for yourself, right, you can really minimize the text of some just couple of words that will ignite that spark of memory of, oh, this is what I was thinking. I've recently been working on a thing that's I ran maybe 10 years ago with 5 pages of notes, and I've started to try and write it out for publication, and I think I'm on like page 20 now. And I'm like halfway there. So you definitely have to put more on the page when you're thinking someone else is going to run it other than you.
Certainly, and especially the more personal it is, the more you can't just rely on standard tropes and things like that. Mm-hmm. And to me, those are the products that I want. Like, I've got standard tropes for days.
Yep.
I want your weird. I want the personal. I want this thing that only came in a half dream from your imagination and you statted it up. And so I find that, like, making all of that work with a product that is going to have a wide appeal is a challenge I'm excited about facing.
Awesome.
Because one of the things about WebDM that's still impressing itself upon me, we're coming up on our 5-year anniversary next week.
Congratulations.
And, we got a special video for you guys. So if you're fans of the channel, hopefully it's ready for you by next week. But it's been accepting the place that WebDM has put me. And for so long, like, I'm an internet lurker. Like, I've been on every forum, every blog, but I rarely post. I rarely comment. I don't usually get engaged. And so it was the same way right before WebDM. And so when my friend said, hey, we can make these video series, let's do it, I found that I enjoyed it, but that the changing nature between, like, it being a personal hobby to something that's public has been one of those that I still go back and forth on. And the more people ask for us to publish something, which of course is natural and people want to see and they want to use it in their games.
Yep.
The more I struggle with that, this is what I do for myself. Would this be acceptable for a wider audience? And, like, going back and forth on who the focus should be on, I think is important, but not something I expected.
It's a tough struggle. I feel like, it reminds me a lot of the project that James Malczewski did with his Dwemer Mount book, right? Where I think he really struggled with figuring out how to take what he was clearly enjoying running and enjoying writing about obliquely in his blog and then translating that into something that's actually usable by other groups. It's tough.
Oh, yeah. It is, yeah. Because when it's just for you, it's all the good parts.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all the parts that excite you. And then when it's for others, you've got to, like, fill in the details that were boring and things like that. True. Who knows what's useful?
Yeah, right.
It's the same struggle. I mean, this is what we'd hear from Gygax, right, over the years of turning Castle Greyhawk, his single page of key per level, into a published product that never fully came to fruition. And it was exactly that struggle of how much do you need to provide to the end user? And so the struggle continues.
Yeah, I find it encouraging to read that. You know, I find it encouraging to say, find an editorial that a blogger has posted and like, because I don't have access to any of it. I don't have any archive from Dragon Magazine. I'm not going to go digging, as much for those snippets. So when I see it on someone's blog, it's really important to me because, like, oh, I'm number one, I'm not alone. Number two, watching these other industry professionals and founders or anything struggle with the same things is helpful for me, you know, two generations of gamers later, or however many, trying to make content that squares that circle, because it has to be interesting. You have to be, people want the heart, the soul, they want something, but also it's got to be usable. It's got to be readable and intelligible.
I guess I would also say don't be afraid to, like, toss in little unfinished hooks, because you never know when your two-word phrase of evil pixie is going to turn into a highly memorable face severing scene.
Yeah, and all of the famous gaming products that people love are half finished.
Yeah.
All of the ones that people talk about and really like are not. They have space for your own creations.
Yep.
Your own imprint.
And Gary Gygax, explicitly said that should always be there. There should always be a hook for some other next step thing leading out of this place. So
yeah,
it's that's solid advice.
Yeah, and I think it mirrors the kind of gaps that you would leave to be filled in play. Right, like we're going to leave the gaps in the product for the individual table to decide what's important, what really happens, who's the real villain, that kind of thing. Because like it's the attempt to systematize and universalize everything, which some versions of D&D seem to really want to do, that makes it bland, unenjoyable to me. And I would rather have something that's much more personal and quirky, even if it is flawed, than the other way around.
Super well put.
As usual, as happens with when chatting with a very interesting and exciting guest, the end of the hour has snuck up upon us. So I'm just going to quickly ask if who has any final thoughts on the original topic of things from 5th edition to migrate into your old school games, or vice versa, old school concepts to migrate into your 5th edition game.
I'll just step in and I'll say this. So listening, I'm so glad we had Jim on, because listening to Jim today has been the single most convincing exposition that you can smoothly switch between zero edition old school ideas and 5th edition play style. And I think that I've been a bit skeptical of that, maybe up until today. And Jim is the single most convincing proselytizer that's possible. And I think it's personally benefited me a lot to have to have him on today. So thank you, Jim, for that.
I wear it with honor. That's great. Thank you. I would say this. My final thought would be to the takeaways from 5th edition that I think work really well in old school. And to me, the first one is that there's that tension in old school of what hit die and hit points represent. And I think the being able to spend hit dice to heal yourself, spending hit dice as a resource for things, like that is a concept and an idea that I play with in a lot of different ways, not just as it relates to healing in original D&D. It's like, do you want an extra spell? Are you willing to sacrifice your blood for it? kind of moment, that kind of thing. I also like the variety of races and the amount of magic that's in the game of 5th edition. I know that's a very new school thing, and a lot of old school DMs and players prefer the more classic fantasy, but I like a group of PCs that looks just weird. I love the Arduin Grimoire as well, right? It's one of the best D&D products I was able to find. So, and so I like that. This is a dragon guy. This is a devil guy. This is a fairy lady. We're all in here to, you know, be trash people and have shenanigans and go adventuring. You know, that's why we're here. So I would take, those are the two things that I take back to my old school games with me, because I just, they're what I like about new school. And other than that, it's like this feat, that spell, this monster, you know, on an individual basis.
Awesome.
That's great.
Awesome.
That's fantastic.
One thing I was going to say, which actually one of our viewers beat me to the punch, has pointed out, really, really enjoying the advantage system, the advantage disadvantage in 5th edition. Here's the interesting thing. I've totally come around on advantage and disadvantage. When I first encountered it, I was a little like, I'm not sure about this, and it makes the math hard. I've seen other systems now lift that and use that solely as your sole modifier, right? And you don't give arbitrary plus ones or plus twos, only have an advantage disadvantage system. I find that really freeing. Very easy rule to just toss in there and say you have advantage or you have disadvantage, and that's the end of the story. We're not going to worry about how things stack or whatnot. They're just only two options, advantage and disadvantage, and they cancel each other out.
Yeah.
I could see using that in games. I could definitely see. I use it a lot in 5th, and I could see using it in an old school game.
I'm curious to hear what Dan thinks.
Yeah.
Well, the non-linear map, that for me, that's a big rupture from classic D&D, and the non-linear math makes, like, even from the player's aspect, makes the probabilities extra hard to determine. But I got to admit, players pick it up very, very quickly. It's very digestible to players, and that is not a hill that I'm going to die on, because it's clearly been very successful.
The one I'm willing to die on is this. It's one thing. And because it's binary, you either have it or you don't. Disadvantage cancels out advantage. It's quick, it's easy, but having it be the only thing, for me, as 5th edition has gone on, it's been like, I want to see something new. Or, like, sometimes you'll see in Unearthed Arcana, the sort of monthly updates they'll do for 5th edition, is like, okay, well, if you have advantage and you're making this kind of attack, this feature unlocks for you. And so it's like, it's either more complicated, kind of like backwards towards 3rd edition or 4th edition. And what I like, actually, is the way Shadow of the Demon Lord does things. Shadow of the Demon Lord is made by one of the designers of 4th and 5th edition, and you have Banes and Boons, which are D6s. And pairs cancel each other out. So you want 3 Banes, 4 Boons, you got 1 Boon left. And then it's a D6 roll that you add to the D20 or subtract from it, as opposed to an extra D20 roll. So in that sense, it's like an action die or a fate die that sometimes comes up.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty similar to how some of the 5th edition spells like Bless and whatnot work, right? Where you're adding a variable die.
Yeah. And I think that one point in the development of Next, proficiency was going to be an extra die that you roll instead of a flat modifier. And I think it's in the DMG as well for 5th edition as a variant. So, I think that that's sort of my opinion on advantage. When it first came out, I loved it, but now I want to see more. And so I would use it situationally in old school, but I might as well just do like -5 to me, or +5 or something like that.
Yeah, certainly commingling arbitrary pluses and minuses and advantage disadvantage becomes problematic, I think.
Oh yeah. Yes.
All right. Viewers, if you have any opinions on advantage and disadvantage versus flat bonuses versus die bonuses, let us know.
Part.
Drop us a comment in the chat below. Or if you have other thoughts of rules that you like to adapt between old school and 5th edition in either direction, we'd love to hear from you. Drop us a line, let us know what you think, and maybe that will spin off in another show down the road.
That's right, and big thanks to WebDM Jim for being with us. This was a really great episode, actually. And if you'd like to see more of WebDM, look for their channel on YouTube. Go to YouTube, search for WebDM, and you could see the thing that fed into our discussion today, actually, is their discussion on fudging dice versus rolling in the open. They had a whole episode last week about that you could watch. And stay tuned for their anniversary episode that's coming up next week, actually.
Hopefully.
Okay. Or shortly there.
We hope so. We hope so.
Excellent.
Yeah. And also look for their pay. And if you'd like to support them, look on patreon.com for WebDM as well. So you could do that. Yeah. Remember that you can like and follow and subscribe to us on YouTube and Twitter and Twitch by the handle WanderingDMs on all of those sites.
Our show is also available as audio-only podcast format. You can find that on wanderingdms.com, and also all the major podcast carriers such as iTunes, Google Podcasts, etc. If you are listening to our show on one of those carriers, please take a moment to rate and review us. That really helps others find our show, and we super appreciate that.
That's right. And thanks to our patrons who support our show, and if you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And while you're there, you can also look for WebDM and support them at the same time. Would be even extra fantastic. You'd be rolling with advantage, so to speak. Don't forget, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.